Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
On today's show, Rachel Cockerell. On her new book, Melting Point, Family, Memory, and the Search for a Promised Land.
Rachel Cockerell was born and raised in London, the sixth of seven children. She did her BA at the Courtauld Institute and her MA at City University. Her first book, Melting Point, which we're going to talk about today, was researched in Texas, Ohio, New York, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem. Rachel, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we actually talk about the people and the stories in the book, I want to talk about the method of it. So before we do that, can you just give us a quick description about what the book is about?
What the book is about? Well, the elevator pitch I give is that it's about my great-grandfather whose job was sending Russian Jews to Texas. And that kind of gets people nice and confused and surprised, which is the effect I want. So it is about that, but it's also about this forgotten search for an alternative to Palestine that took place in the early 20th century and that sort of echoed down the generations of my family. My great-grandfather was born in Russia. He was a Russian Jew, and his children ended up sort of scattered across the world. My grandmother's brother, his son, went to New York. My grandmother went to London, and their sister ended up in Jerusalem. So it's kind of a story of Jewish migration in the 20th century, but hopefully really driven by characters. Like, it's not a book about events, it's a book about characters.
And so let's talk about the actual format of the book, because it's told entirely in primary sources through the voices of the people that were there at the time. Yeah, tell us about that and why.
Well, I originally tried to write a more conventional family memoir slash history. And as you know, you sort of weave primary sources, quotes, through a sort of narrative. So, you know, the classic Philippe Sands or Edmond Duval, it'll be sort of the author's journey and then also these quotes. But I wasn't in the story really, and I didn't really want to put myself in. So in my first draft, I said things like, this character was clearly conflicted, and then the next sentence would be a quote from the character, which showed the reader that he was conflicted. And I just felt my own input was A, sort of useless, and B, I found it a bit annoying. Like, my voice was really pointless. I had been reading George Saunders's Lincoln in the Bardo, which is entirely narrated by real primary sources, made up primary sources, and also ghosts. So I knew something like this was possible. And also in documentaries, a lot of documentaries don't have voiceovers. So what I did was I wove together all these eyewitness accounts so that it's really like this cast of characters telling the story, and there's no sort of overarching narrator or voiceover. And what I really loved was that sometimes these, you know, these voices from the past seem to sort of almost fight with each other or contradict each other or back each other up or tell the same scene from two different perspectives or three different perspectives or 10 different perspectives. It just feels like you're sort of in a room with these people and they're elbowing each other out of the way in order to tell you their side of the story.
So how then did that develop then? First of all, I guess, tell us something about the research and how you found a lot of these primary sources. But then how did the book, once you'd made that decision to cut yourself out of it, how did the formatting of the book develop?
Yeah, so I always thought of history as sort of reading history books and feeling sort of removed from the past and being told a sort of analysis of it by some dusty old man wearing tweed. That was how history was sort of presented to me at school. But really researching this book, I just ignored all the secondary sources, which means the sort of commentary on what happened, and went straight to things that were written by people who were there at the time. So accounts in newspapers, diaries, letters, memoirs. And yeah, that, I mean, it really sort of immersed me in this story. And then, yeah, to sort of weave it together, yeah, I wove together, as I said, all these different sides of the story. And there were moments where I thought, okay, this is the moment where it's all going to fall apart. I need to put myself in here. For example, the main character in the book, who's actually not a family member, he's called Israel Zangwill, who I'm sure we'll talk about. He persuaded my great-grandfather to leave Ukraine, where he lived, and move to England just before the outbreak of World War I. And I had read one sort of vague mention in a book saying Dr. Jockelman, who's my great-grandfather, was prevailed upon by Zangwill to move to London. This was in a book written, I think, in the 1980s. And it had no footnote. And I actually tracked down the author, who was like an old guy who now lives in Jerusalem and has never written a book since. I think it was based on his PhD. And I said, you mentioned this in your book. Do you have any idea where you found this information? And he said, no, obviously, I have no idea. I wrote that book like many decades ago. And it took me years, but I think maybe 3 or 4 years into the process of writing, I stumbled upon a letter which this writer must have stumbled upon himself, from Zangwill to my great-grandfather Jockelman, saying, your future belongs to England. You must now come over here, bring your wife and children. And so it was moments like that where I thought, oh, I need to sort of say this myself. And then actually I found just the perfect line which I could plug in and fill this sort of gap.
So the book starts off with some, at this remove, like quite mad sounding descriptions of Theodore Herzl. He's the most impressive man I've ever seen. He has the bearing of a king and that sort of thing. So first of all, remind us who he was.
Yeah, sure. So Theodore Herzl is the founder of Zionism. And I didn't particularly know who he was when I started the book. If I had any association with the name Herzl, I thought maybe it was sort of a great thinker from the past who, you know, maybe had a long white beard like Charles Darwin as an old man or George Bernard Shaw. I thought of him as this sort of dusty figure just stranded in the past who had founded this, you know, the Zionist movement. But actually, as I read more about him, I discovered he was a young journalist in his early 40s when he founded Zionism. He was a sort of very cool, popular journalist as well. He lived in Vienna, and he was sort of one of the most popular people in Vienna. His journalism was often sort of, you know, witty commentaries on what was going on in, you know, cafe society or funny things that had happened to his family. He was Jewish, but he was very much a sort of assimilated Jew. But he saw this rise in anti-Semitism across Europe, and he also saw, from his perspective, you know, this place, Palestine, which seemed to him empty, and maybe the Jews could return there and it would all, you know, it seemed too good to be true. I think he was quite a grandiose person. And I think he thought, maybe I could lead this movement and sort of, you know, be written into history forever, which is, you know, it is what happened. But I think there was a sort of element of ego in there somewhere. So yes, he was this extremely glamorous, extremely charismatic, magnetic person. Apparently, if you met him on the street in Vienna and you were going one direction and he was going the other, you would turn and just walk with him and abandon whatever you were going to do, because wherever he was going was probably more interesting. And as you said, the writing about him at the time, I mean, it's a lot of men writing about him. And it's almost, I mean, the men who knew him, and women as well, but the men who wrote about him seem to be almost in love with him. They all talk about his beauty and his perfect features and how just everything about him made you want to draw nearer and nearer. So he is really where the book starts. And this insanely charismatic figure who founded Zionism almost sort of by accident.
There's a bunch of conferences in Basel in Switzerland normally. There's one in London as well, but most of them are in Basel. So tell us something about the description of the first Basel conference as described in the book.
Sure. So Theodore Herzl founds Zionism. And really, the way he found Zionism is he writes what he calls a book, but is really, I think it's about 70 pages. It's more of a pamphlet. The title is The Jewish State. And most people don't actually read it, especially people in Austria and in Vienna, where he lives. They just say, you know, is this a joke? Why have you done this? Why do you want the Jews to leave Austria and leave Europe and go to this dusty province of the Ottoman Empire called Palestine? So, yeah, so he writes this pamphlet, and the real beginning of Zionism is the first Zionist Congress. He announces that the Jews are going to meet and talk about how Palestine is going to be acquired. And he invites Jews from all over the world. He sort of sends an open invitation. And truly, you know, Jews from, I think, almost every continent travel to Basel for this Congress. And, you know, they talk about it with such reverence and such excitement. And it sounds like the atmosphere at that first Congress was just sort of electric. And Theodor Herzl, you know, made this rousing speech about, today we have laid the keystone for, you know, for a future Israel. And I think they really think it's only going to be a few years, maybe even 1 year, until Palestine belongs to the Jews. Herzl ends his speech by saying, this year we are in Basel, who knows where we will be next year, perhaps in Jerusalem. If he only knew then that it would be another 40-something years, 48 years, until a Jewish state was founded, I'm sure he'd be quite horrified, really.
So let's talk a little bit about why, I guess, they want to do this. You've already mentioned the sort of rise of anti-Semitism across Europe, and this is slightly out of sequence because there's a couple of conferences that happened before this, but there's an incident in Russia that's described in the book in a town called Kishinev. So what happens there?
Yeah, it's the first pogrom of the 20th century. And pogrom is when, well, at the time it was Russians going through the streets and smashing up Jewish property and killing any Jews that they found. So around 50 Jews were killed in the course of 2 or 3 days in this city called Kishinev in the Russian Empire. And it's the beginning of hundreds of pogroms that take place in the next few years. And at that point, Jews in Russia really think, we can't stay here any longer. We've got to get out and go somewhere. And yeah, they sort of turn their eyes towards America.
One of the people who's at these conferences, somebody you've already mentioned, is Israel Zangwill. Tell us something about who he was.
Israel Zangwill is sort of my favourite character. I think I mentioned earlier, he took over the book, really. I started out writing a book about my great-grandfather, but Zangwill just informed me that he would be the main character of this book. He was at one point, probably at the beginning of the 20th century, the most famous Jewish figure in the English-speaking world. His novels, you know, were huge bestsellers. He would go on these lecture tours across America and sell out, even if he was in some tiny little town. Wherever he went in London, you know, whether he was walking along Fleet Street or along Piccadilly, people would swarm towards him and almost sort of clasp his hand and say, Zangwill, I love your book so much. He was also an extremely shambolic figure, which I think is the main reason I like him. He was apparently the worst dressed man in London, the ugliest man in the world. He always had sort of pieces of paper falling out of his pockets, and he always had a bundle of manuscripts under his arm, very short-sighted and sort of walked with a bit of a shuffle. But also, like Herzl, really funny and magnetic and charming. He had such an incredible turn of phrase, would sort of coin these new phrases, that the word Zangwillism sort of entered the English vocabulary, meaning a phrase coined by Zangwill. So, you know, he never spoke in cliches. He just always spoke in such an original and fascinating and funny way that you couldn't help but draw near and listen again, like Herzl.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Rachel Cockrell, and we're talking about her book, Melting Point, Family, Memory, and the Search for a Promised Land. And Rachel, an idea comes up at one of these congresses, which is Herzl has been promised some land in British East Africa, basically modern-day Uganda, or Juganda, as it gets called at one point in the book.
Yeah.
By somebody I'd never heard of, but who turns out to be Neville Chamberlain's father, who is basically the minister for the colonies. Tell us about this plan.
Yeah, so Theodor Herzl, at some point in the early 1900s, realized that it might be a while until Palestine was acquired for the Jews. He then approached the British government and said, could you give me part of one of your colonies as a sort of temporary refuge for the Jews? He had this meeting with Joseph Chamberlain, who, as you said, was the father of Neville and was a lot more famous in his time. And I think would be quite horrified that we now associate the word Chamberlain with his son and not with him. So Herzl and Chamberlain met, and Chamberlain, like everyone else, was completely charmed by Herzl and said to him, I have seen a land for you on my travels, and that's Uganda. He had taken a train through British East Africa. It actually transpired that it was Kenya, not Uganda. But I think in the early 20th century, British people thought East Africa was quite vague in their minds, the actual sort of specific geography of it. So Chamberlain had taken a train through British East Africa and looked out at this land and thought, oh, I'll give that to the Zionists. So he offered it to Herzl, who then transmitted this offer to the Zionist Congress, where it was met with huge shock and uproar. When Herzl made this announcement, people stood up in the audience and shouted traitor at him because they thought he was betraying, you know, Palestine and this longed for dream of returning to Palestine.
The crops up various different possible destinations over the course of the book before we even get to Texas, which we're going to come on to. Mesopotamia, a part of Libya is mentioned at one point, and much later Angola. And it's interesting reading the primary sources about these discussions about these countries, because obviously this is, you know, right in the middle of the height of colonialism. And nobody really considers the people that are already living in any of these places, do they?
No, definitely not. You know, there's this phrase that Joseph Chamberlain's son, Neville, said in World War II that, or I guess just before, this faraway country, this faraway land of which we know so little, talking about Czechoslovakia. And I think that attitude was very much true in the first half of the 20th century. That these lands were so distant and far-flung that you had such a very little sense of them and a sense of the people who lived there. And also, you know, this was sort of the dying days of the British Empire. So it was thought that any land that you wanted, you got, sort of thing.
Herzl dies around this time, and Zangwill basically ends up splitting off because, as you mentioned, that the Congress was basically pretty much split down the middle by the British East Africa plan. And so Zangwill forms something called the ITO. So what was that?
Yeah. So in the early 20th century, Zionism split. And, you know, this has been completely forgotten and sort of wiped from the history books. But when the Zionists voted to reject Uganda as a Jewish homeland, some of the Zionists in the Congress stood up and stormed out. This included my great-grandfather and it included Zangwill. And they formed what was really a rival movement to the Zionist organization, which, as you said, was called the Jewish Territorial Organization. And their sort of would-be motto was, if we cannot get the Holy Land, we can make another land holy. I think they saw that Palestine would not be attainable, at least for some time. And they sort of scoured the earth for a temporary alternative to Palestine. As you said, you know, these slightly surreal sounding places for a possible Jewish homeland, Angola, Australia, Canada, Mexico, even they sort of almost considered Antarctica. Zangwill said, one gentleman has suggested to me an uninhabited land. Unfortunately, it's in Antarctica. All these plans fell through for one reason or another. For example, the Australian government said a Jewish colony in Australia is quite out of the question. Other lands, sort of the geography wasn't quite right. Maybe there was no water to be found anywhere in the, you know, in the whole country that they were considering. So really, you know, Zangwill and my great-grandfather searched the whole world for a temporary promised land and didn't find one.
We should introduce David Jockelman at this point, because we haven't really discussed him at the moment, and he is sort of quite central, not only to the book, but to its author. Sure. So tell us something about who David Jockelman was.
David Jockelman was my great-grandfather. He was never really talked about in my family. There was a lot of talk about my grandmother, who was called Granny Fanny, who was his daughter. But I remember sort of almost no mentions of her father, David Jockelman. If he was mentioned at all by my father or his siblings or cousins, it was just that he was a banker or a businessman, or he was involved in stocks and shares. And I knew almost nothing else about him. When I started writing the book, I was wondering how and why my family came to London. I knew they had come from Russia. And that was really when I found out about the Galveston Plan. I was looking online and I found books saying Dr. Jockelman was instrumental in the Galveston movement. And I had no idea what the word Galveston even meant, whether it was a person or a place. I soon discovered that it was a place, and that it was a place in Texas where, you know, all these Russian Jews went at the beginning of the 20th century. But David Jockelman, I mean, he's still, having finished this book, I almost feel closer to Zangwill than I do to Jockelman, partly because he wrote almost nothing about himself. He was, as one person put it, a mysteriously and deliberately unpublicized figure in the Zionist movement. But yeah, he's sort of the silent heart of the book, the sort of center of the book, which everything else revolves around. But yeah, I feel that maybe I'm more similar to the shambolic Zangwill than I am to Jockelman.
So before we actually talk about the Galveston movement, I just wanted you to say something about, I guess, the Jews of Europe's relationship with America in the early 20th century. It just so happens that 2 weeks ago today, as we're recording, I was in the Lower East Side and went to the incredible Tenement Museum there for the first time and got to actually see what living there at that time would have been like for some of these people. So yeah, tell us something about what what the Lower East Side of New York would have been like at the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, the Lower East Side was the greatest Jewish center the world had ever known at the beginning of the 20th century. I think there were around 1 million Jews just in this really what's a sort of neighborhood. If you walked through the Lower East Side in sort of 1905, 1910, you would hear Yiddish, you know, you wouldn't really hear much English. You would see kosher restaurants and Yiddish theatres and synagogues and, you know, these buzzing markets with all sorts of strange looking foods and strange smells. So, yeah, the Jews had started going there at the turn of the century. And then by sort of 1910, every Jewish person in Russia had a friend or a cousin or a family member who was in New York. So most of the Jews in Russia wanted to leave Russia and their sights were set on New York. One person said New York is overflowing with Jews. So that was really what it was like at the time.
So the Galveston movement then, I guess we should talk about another figure in this, an American man called Jacob Schiff. Who was he?
Jacob Schiff was a German Jewish banker whose family had come to America, I think, a few decades before. So, you know, in the late 1800s, he lived in New York and he didn't live in the Lower East Side. He was, you know, far too wealthy and grand for that. I think he lived in the Upper East Side. But he saw these ships arriving every day with Russian Jews. America didn't have immigration quotas at the beginning of the 20th century. So really, the harbor of New York just received ship after ship, day in, day out, unloading immigrants, mostly Russian Jews who just went straight to the Lower East Side. He said that he thought this would create a menace in the rest of the country, that, you know, if these immigrant ships kept arriving, it would lead to a rise in anti-Semitism. And he said, this we must not risk. So he wanted, you know, his fellow Jews to be saved from Russia, and he wanted them to come to America, but he didn't want them to create a problem for him and his fellow, you know, wealthy German Jews who were much longer established. So he had this bright idea, what if the ships coming across the Atlantic stopped before they reached New York and took a sharp left turn in the ocean and sailed down to the Gulf of Mexico, where they could land and the Jews could arrive in Texas and then spread out across the middle of America.
So tell us something about how this actually worked in practice then, once the Galveston movement was up and running.
Well, my great-grandfather's job was to travel across the western parts of the Russian Empire, persuading Jews who were about to leave for New York to go to Texas instead. And their response was usually, but I want to go to America. And by this they meant, but I want to go to New York. For them, America and New York were sort of interchangeable. They both referred to a small town at the edge of the New World where all their friends were. So really, he said to them, New York is sort of full up already, and Texas is empty, and you can go there and it's warm and you can get a great job and live a much better quality of life. So then the ships would depart from Europe and go, you know, go across the Atlantic. And Jews arrived in Texas for between the years 1907 and 1914. And all their descendants are sort of scattered across the American West today. 10,000 Russian Jews went to Texas. And so, you know, I'm not very good at maths, but it must be in the hundreds of thousands today. I met someone the other day who went to school, a quite Jewish school in Memphis, Tennessee. And he said that all his friends who were Jewish, their ancestors had come to America through Galveston, Texas. He was the sort of odd one out because his ancestors had come through New York.
We've obviously spent most of the interview building up to the Galveston movement, but as part of your research, you discovered that David Jockelman had been married previously to your great grandmother and had had a family, and his son became a famous playwright in New York, M. Joe Bashi, and the middle section of the book has a great look at the sort of New York demimonde, the sort of theatre and writing worlds. Tell us something about who M. Joe Bashi was.
Yeah, M. Joe Bashi was born Emmanuel Jockelman. He was my great-grandfather's son and my grandmother's brother. He was born in Russia, but he went over to America, I think aged around 12. It was just after the Titanic had sunk, so it must have been a slightly nerve-wracking journey across the Atlantic. As soon as he got to America, he shook off this sort of unwieldy name, Emmanuel Jockelman, and renamed himself M. Joe, you know, a combination of both his names, and then made up the surname Bashi and became a sort of experimental playwright in New York in the 1920s. He mixed with people like John Dos Passos and Ernest Hemingway and founded this experimental theater movement. And it was so funny reading the sort of, you know, the play reviews from the time, because they were saying, oh God, these newfangled ways of creating theatre of 1927, can't we just go back to the old-fashioned methods of 1926? So really, they were very ahead of their time. And these plays were all about modernity and the radio age and subways and all these, you know, skyscrapers, all these things that sort of define 1920s New York. He then married a sort of Southern belle from North Carolina called Doris Troutman. Extremely beautiful young woman with a sort of heavy drawl, and they had a daughter. So this daughter was half a sort of Southern belle and half a Russian Jew. And M. Joe Bashi, the father, named his daughter M. Joe Bashi II.
And you spent many evenings talking to her on the telephone as part of the research as well. Tell me something about her.
Yeah, again, she was a family member who I barely knew of her existence. She's my grandmother's brother's daughter, but she was really never mentioned in my family. At one point, while I was writing, I found, you know, I was starting to read about M. Joe Bashi Sr. And I said to my father, have you heard of this person called M. Joe Bashi? I think he was a distant relative of ours. He was a playwright in New York. My father said, I remember M. Joe Bashi, but she was a woman and she wasn't an experimental playwright in New York. She was just a bit older than me, and she came over to England to visit us from New York in 1951. So this, I was determined to track down this other M. Joe Bashi, and I found that she was 90 years old, and lived in Canada with her husband. So I called her up in early 2020, and we talked for maybe an hour or two, and she told me about her upbringing in New York in the 1930s and about her father and about her mother. And it was the beginning of around a year of weekly phone conversations, which I transcribed. And then I sort of crafted this into a sort of part of the book, which is really narrated by her. MJ Bashay II becomes a sort of one of the main characters in the middle part of the book, talking about what it was like to grow up in the melting pot of New York in the 1930s.
So I've been talking to Rachel Cockerell. We've been talking about her book, Melting Point, Family, Memory and the Search for a Promised Land, which is out now in the UK from Wildfire Books. Rachel, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thank you so much, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.